Good morning. Please be seated. All right, we have one case on our remaining 10:30 docket. It's Leek versus Campbell. If the clerk will please announce counsel for the parties. All right, Mr. Leek.
May it please the court. I represent my brother and sister-in-law, Scott and Susan Leek, against the Campbells. The facts of this case are simply undisputed. The Campbells knew about the deed restrictions. They failed to submit plans and specs in advance in order to install two portable structures and a carport, an aluminum RV shelter. Both the portable structures that were installed are dropped off the back of a truck with minor assembly. The RV shelter was constructed in less than a day on a bolt-together assembly. The Leeks filed suit to enjoin and remove the violations and sought attorney's fees. Both sides filed motions for summary judgment in the trial court. The court granted the Campbell's motion for summary judgment and denied the Leeks. We appeal. The trial court erred by granting the Campbell's motion for summary judgment and not the Leeks. In the event the court overrules my point of error number one, then the award of attorney's fees to the Campbells is simply inequitable and unjust under these circumstances and should be reversed. This case turns completely on the Buckner opinion written by our Chief Justice. The Buckner opinion is different in several ways. First, in the Buckner opinion, the appellant there sought the advance approval from the association before starting its improvements. Here, the Campbells did not seek such an approval. They just went ahead and did it. In addition, Buckner's language appears to be overbroad in that it states it applies to any situation in which the improvements are completed prior to filing suit. In our situation today, that should be limited to its facts where approval was sought in advance. Finally, you can look at Buckner as simply a reversal of a motion for summary judgment in which this court determined that there was a fact issue and remanded it for trial. Neither one of those situations applies here. If Buckner applies in this case, then the construction that this court deems these covenants would be rendering the covenant simply unenforceable as a matter of fact and as a matter of law. That violates the Texas Property Code provision that states that restrictive covenants should be liberally construed. It also violates the Supreme Court directives that restrictive covenants should be liberally construed in order to harmonize and give effect to all provisions of the restrictive covenants. In this case, directed to page 3 of the covenants themselves, the right to enforce specifically states that no building shall be erected, installed, constructed, or whatever, unless approval is sought in advance from, in this case, the Architectural Control Committee. Then it states procedure for approval shall be as in paragraph 3, which just follows that. You do not reach the right to have deemed approval in paragraph 3 unless you comply with the condition that you submit the plans for approval in advance. Here, that did not happen. Basically, if Buckner's position and the appellee's position controls in this situation, the restrictive covenants in this case are rendered ineffective, meaningless. That would give basically an open carte blanche to any homeowner to do anything they wanted without any consequences whatsoever.
Wouldn't it also then put the burden on all the homeowners of any development to become investigators and be watching constantly?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It would be like, you know, standing ready for, like a police state, standing ready with your guard to make sure somebody doesn't do anything. Because without the notice, there's no opportunity to review and approve and adjust to see exactly what's going on. In this particular case, the portable shed and the gazebo were basically pre-assembled units dropped off the back of a truck. The RV shelter was a prefabricated kit that was bolted together by an assembly man in an afternoon. Your Honor, I'm a good lawyer and I'm pretty fast, but I'm not that fast. And, you know, getting down here and getting an injunction under those circumstances is just clearly impractical. And I've cited the court to many cases in foreign jurisdictions that specifically address those issues, mainly because we couldn't find a case in our jurisdiction that did. Unless the procedure is followed, the right to deemed approval doesn't exist because it's a condition precedent that you have to request the approval in writing. It's undisputed the Campbells did not do that. Buckner should not apply in all situations in which construction is completed prior to suit being filed. In this case, it's clearly impractical to do that, simply because it's so fast, the way that they could drop these things off and, you know, assemble them and bolt them together very, very quickly. If you construe these restrictive covenants as the appellee would do and isolate this paragraph 3 procedure by itself, you basically render meaningless paragraph 2, which requires the advance notice, and you render all of these specific express restrictive covenants meaningless. Because without 2 and the express covenants being included as part of harmonizing the entire document by reading it together, then the whole document is basically meaningless.
Well, and it kind of hard to harmonize the entire document when the second paragraph says, in any event? I mean, in any event means in any event.
Well, if you isolate that paragraph by itself, I would agree with the court's analysis. But in order to give meaning to the rest of the document and harmonize that document with that provision, paragraph specifically 2 specifically states the procedure shall be as follows, but no structure can be erected absent advance notice. And so if you isolate paragraph 3, then you're correct. But if you isolate paragraph 3, that goes in the face of rules of construction because it doesn't harmonize and give effect to the remaining part of the document. In this place,
my point is it really doesn't. I mean, they're conflicting. The paragraphs are somewhat conflicting, and it seems like to me that the wiser thing was, in light of the Buckner opinion and the fact that there aren't any other Texas cases approving the interpretation that you want, for these organizations to have reworded their this provision.
Well, Your Honor, I wasn't there in 1987. All I can tell you is that the intent of the drafter was to harmonize and create a consistent neighborhood that is the same for all participants in the neighborhood. The intent of the document was to make consistency throughout the neighborhood. In this case, if you isolate one provision, you basically ignore and do not give effect to the other provision. However, if you take paragraph 2 and you read in paragraph 2 where it says it should be, the procedure is as in paragraph 3, and then you read paragraph 3 and in there it specifically refers back to paragraph 2, I think you have to read both of those together, not one or the other. In this particular case, it is undisputed that the Campbells did not give the notice and they violated the restrictive covenants. All three of the things they did are an express violation of specific covenants in the deed restrictions. For the court to then, after denying our motion for summary judgment, to award them attorney's fees is clearly inequitable and just in this matter. They do not come to court with clean hands. They admit that they violated the deed restrictions. They admit that they didn't give the notice timely, but yet at the same time, they were awarded attorney's fees. That adds insult to injury in this case. And I would ask the court to reverse the trial court's decision, grant the leak summary judgment, and the alternative, if not, then at least reverse the award of attorney's fees as being inequitable and unjust. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. Pratt.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'd like to start off by talking about the covenant itself. I want to talk about Buckner, obviously, but I want to talk about the language first that we're dealing with. And as Judge Gabriel pointed out, it uses the word any. The covenant itself that the committee drafted uses the word in any event. And it goes on in the second clause, the final clause of that paragraph, to say approval will not be required and the restrictive covenants herein contained shall be deemed to have been fully complied with. So we're dealing with a clause that makes absolutely no reference to submission of plans ahead of time, not a clause that deals with requesting approval. The language says in any event. And more importantly, the first clause of that paragraph specifically states that in the event the committee hasn't approved or disapproved within 15 days after plans, specifications, and plot plan have been submitted. So the first clause specifically addresses pre-submission or pre-construction submission of plans. The second clause makes absolutely no reference. It uses the words in any event. So just from looking at the language of the covenant itself, the inquiry should end there. And indeed, that's what the Buckner Court addressed in addressing a virtually identical covenant in that case. If I recall correctly, the only difference was Buckner dealt with a 30-day approval period, whereas the covenant we were dealing with today has a 15-day approval period.
But there is a huge factual difference, isn't there, as well, because in this case there was no notice given or request for approval.
I wouldn't say that that's a huge factual difference, Your Honor. That is truly the case. But more importantly, Buckner didn't just deal with pre-construction submission of plans. It also dealt with homeowners who continued to construct a disapproved improvement to the property, yet the court still said, the language says, in any event. So that's what we're really left with at the end of the day. And indeed, the court went on to note on in the discussion of its analysis that the use of the word any shows an intent to describe all scenarios other than those in which the ACC gives its explicit approval or fails to disapprove submitted plans within the time period. More importantly, the court gave some hypothetical scenarios under which that would occur, the most important one being that when the homeowner has not complied by requesting pre-approval. So the court specifically acknowledged that in any event would cover scenarios in which approval was never requested. And indeed, that's likely what the judge below in the trial court based his opinion on.
Do you agree that the intent of this restrictive covenant was to provide for uniformity in the neighborhood?
I would, Your Honor. Yes.
So let's take one of his scenarios and say that some homeowner decides to go out and buy 20 of these tough sheds and have them all delivered on the same day, doesn't ask for any pre-approval for that, and then just has it dotted all over their property. And it's done before anybody can do anything about it. So under your interpretation of this, there's nothing you can do about that, even though that would have wreaked havoc with the uniformity of the neighborhood. Would you agree?
While it seems somewhat absurd, Your Honor, I would agree.
Aren't there construction rules that say that you shouldn't construe something to reach an absurd result?
Absolutely. And if that were the case, then we might be dealing with that absurdity rule of construction. But that's not what we're dealing with here, Your Honor. We're dealing with three improvements, I believe, that were challenged. All of which, if I recall correctly, are in the backyard, not very visible. So from a uniformity perspective, I don't know that it changes it much. But the more important point is that the committee that drafted this language left this language intact following the Buckner opinion, following every other case that has followed the Buckner opinion or addressed similar covenants. And the bottom line is that every court that has addressed this issue in this state has said that the word in any event means just that, in any event. Now, I'd like to move on, if I may, to the attorney's fees issue, because I think, frankly, that the Buckner case addresses this issue. The Buckner case is on all fours with regard to the question before this court. And if the committee had wanted a different result, they certainly could have changed the language, but they failed to do so. So they, just like the Campbells, the committee has to be bound by it, and the leaks have to be bound by the language that they have chosen to enforce. Now, on the second issue, the leaks have challenged the trial court's awarding of attorney's fees under the Declaratory Judgments Act. So, as a starting point, I believe we're all aware that the Declaratory Judgments Act grants very broad discretion to the trial court to grant attorney's fees that are reasonable and necessary, obviously, and that are also just and equitable under the circumstances. Now, trial court's decision on declaratory judgment award of fees is given broad discretion, and this court has recognized numerous times that it will be challenged or reversed only upon a clear showing of an abuse of discretion. And we don't have that in this case. Furthermore, in their reply brief, appellants have suggested to the court that the Campbells have attempted to use the Declaratory Judgments Act as an avenue to otherwise unrecoverable fees. But that's not what we have here. Indeed, as the Texas Supreme Court noted in the MBM financial case, the Declaratory Judgment Act allows fees to be awarded to either party. And numerous courts of appeal, including this court in the Falls County case, have recognized that fees are authorized in defense of declaratory judgment cases, just as they are in prosecuting a declaratory judgment case. So we're not dealing here with a case where the Campbells have attempted to bootstrap attorney's fees into a case through the DEC action statute. The ordinary situation we see that is when there's a breach of contract case or a breach of warranty case and the defendant seeks a declaration of rights in an attempt to bring in attorney's fees. But that's just not what we have here. We have plaintiffs who brought a claim under the Declaratory Judgments Act, and we have defendants, now appellees, that merely asserted their rights to recover fees and requested that the trial court award fees as authorized by the statute and the numerous cases that have construed that statute. So we're not dealing with a case of otherwise unrecoverable fees. And furthermore, there has been no showing, despite the arguments presented by appellants, that there's a reason to reverse the trial court's ruling from an abuse of discretion standpoint. There's never been an admission of a violation in this case. There's never been any evidence shown that the Campbells were in a position to where it would be inequitable or unjust for them to recover their attorney's fees. Not at the trial court, not at this level, and certainly the trial court was acting well within its discretion in granting the fees that Judge Holman granted below. So if the court has no further questions on either of these issues, I would cede the rest of my time to the court.
All right, thank you, Mr. Pratt. Mr. Lee, rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
In direct response to Appellee's counsel's argument regarding the or in any event language, if you look at the way that that language is written in that sentence, it actually refers specifically to the prior sentence. It doesn't refer to the whole document. It refers to the prior sentence, which basically states, after approval is sought. And therefore, it modifies that only after approval is sought. In this case, it's undisputed approval was not sought. So that mandatory language, as referenced by both paragraph 2 and paragraph 3, requires this to be, in effect, a condition precedent to seek the approval prior to getting the deemed approval for lack of filing suit. As to the attorney's fees, Appellee's argument flies right in the face of Justice Gardner's opinion in Warrantech, decided by this court. The sole counterclaim made by the defendants at trial was for attorney's fees under the DGA. They sought no affirmative relief. All they sought was attorney's fees. They didn't even seek to have their conduct deemed to be approved or in compliance with the deed restrictions. They cite the Falls County case again by this court as precedent for that. But I submit that the Falls County case is different on its facts in two respects. Number one, the Falls County case was a governmental entity suing a private party. That private party counterclaimed for declaratory judgment. It doesn't say what it claimed for, but it's implied in the way the opinion is written that they counterclaimed for affirmative relief in addition to what the county sued for. The county then non-suited its case. And they went to court after the non-suit on their counterclaim and received attorney's fees. That's simply not the case here. There's been no affirmative relief sought by the appellees in this matter. And if the court follows the Warrantech opinion by this court and the Justice Gardner, then there should not be an attorney fee award made because the sole purpose of the counterclaim was to obtain the Declaratory Judgments Act's premise of an award of attorney's fees. Especially in light of the wrongdoing in this case, where it is admitted in the summary judgment evidence before the court at trial and before this court on the appellate record, that the appellees violated every restrictive covenant and did not follow the proper procedure, that this matter should be reversed and rendered in favor of the Leakes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Thank you, Mr. Pratt. We appreciate all of your submissions and your briefing and your arguments today as well.
Thank you.
Your case is now submitted. That concludes our oral